This is Phil Farron.
And I am driving home.
It's Thursday today,
and it's a little dark because I dropped off at the church. We had a tech crew meeting today, production team meeting, whatever it's called. So it's just after 8. I'm heading home, so I'm not going to be able to see my notes, but that's okay. Because I've been mulling and thinking, and this is going to be a little bit stream of consciousness, but it's important, it's one of those things that it's trying to get a handle on the great war of words that exists now in gender, but we'll get to that in a minute. All is well at work. We finished up the move of the web store this week. That took a little more time than I was expecting because we had a few little hiccups that had to be taken care of, but that seems to be done. So now I'm back on some of the other projects I'm working on and it'll be fine. It's really interesting. We've been having some discussions about moving forward. What do we do about some of our more sensitive data? How do we protect that? There's all kinds of different ways to do that. We're looking at tokenization, which enlists the help of other companies. And it's a pretty interesting idea. Basically, they just generate this random token for you for every piece of safe or sensitive information that you have. You give them the sensitive information. For that particular sensitive information, they generate you a random token and pass it back to you, and that's your token for that. And then to get to that information, you actually have to pass them the correct keys and things back and forth, and then they say, okay, there you go, there's your piece of information. The nice thing about that is that all of the data that's stored on your side for sensitive data is completely unrecognizable. You can get breached, and there is nothing anyone can do with that data, because they have to not only get your tokens, they have to get through that gateway with the proper credentials, and all of that can be locked down. So it makes it much harder. So it's interesting. We're talking about it. Obviously, there's cost involved. Looking at that. Writing, wow, I did not think, I think I mentioned last week that I was a little behind. I just didn't think there was any way I was going to get to 10,000 words last week, and I did. and the other problem is I knew that I was going to lose about 1,500 words in the process, and so I think on Friday, I only logged 2,000 words written, but I think I lost about 1,500 words in the process, so I actually made up that and gained back and got to 2,000, so that's about 3,500 words that day. And then on Saturday, I did the same thing. Really kind of pedal to the metal stuff, rewrite a bunch of stuff, but I think it's fine now. This week's been much better. I've been settling in. I was a little tired last night, so I was off about 300 words for the week by the end of last night. And then tonight, I'm going to lose another 500, so I'm down about 800. But yeah, I can make that up. Compared to last week, I'm in really good shape. And I'm in a pretty interesting part of the book. I still don't know. Exactly where I'm going with this book. I mean, some books, like book 8 was good because I knew where I needed to land and it was just a matter of filling the stuff up and getting there. And I knew some points along the way. So I basically had a plot outline on book 8 because I had been setting it up for so long. So that was a pretty easy write. This one's going to be interesting because I'm actually filling some time. Without giving too much away, book 3 of this next set of 8 which will actually be book 11, has a pretty dramatic reveal in it. The lines of the poem that I'm dealing with now in the second stanza, it starts out, "Surely some revelation is at hand." Beginning of the second stanza says, "Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand." And then the third line is basically, "The second coming, hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight." And so, I mean, that's kind of, you know, in the short run, that's what I'm setting up for. I'm setting up for book 11. And I need to be laying these first two books, the groundwork for book 11. And there are pieces of that, you know, that I can set, but there's some things that I have to wait until book 11. And so it's finding filler in there. It's basically the same position I was in book 5, actually in book 6 as well, and book 3. You know, I needed some filler space in there. And so I cashed in some of my chips on some of the latent revelations, because I have these revelations about the characters I'm going to make at some point. And whenever I make that revelation, that I got to cash in that chip. But I think it's fine. I think it's fine. It's really interesting. I was talking to my godson this week, and he had finished the book, and so we were talking about the book, and he said, "Wow, you really pulled a lot of things, you know, together," or something like that. He said, "You know, there's a lot of things that tied together in this book." And I said, "Yeah." And then I laughed and I said, "And I didn't hardly plan any of them." You know, it was just as I was writing it, all through the first 7 books, I was throwing spaghetti against the wall to see what would stick. And then in book 8, I was like, "And I can pick that up, and I can pick that up, and I can pick that up." So things sometimes work out, which is cool. Anyways, so I'm on book 9. I'm trudging along with that. I'm into chapter 6, I think, now. Which the first little story I'm telling, I really thought it was only just going to be a 2 or 3 chapter thing, and now it's extended into 6, which is good. But it's just settling into this new pattern a little bit now. So it's fun. It's fun. All is well with the family. Everybody's good. We had a little bit of sadness in that a family friend, been friends for a long time. His name was D. Harwood, and he had a terrible accident. I drove by it, didn't even realize it was him there at Maranatha. And then this last week, he did die, and his funeral was Monday. It was a gorgeous funeral. And Dee, he was the maintenance guy, one of the maintenance guys at Maranatha. And then he was also, very faithful to his church, but a life well lived. And it was very much evidenced by the funeral. Because this is a guy that if you just see him in passing, you would not expect that his funeral would fill the main floor at Praise Assembly. The main floor at Praise Assembly seats 900 people, elbow to elbow. And the main floor was more than adequately populated. So I need to talk to my son-in-law because he's better at estimating crowds, but I'd be surprised if there wasn't 750 people there on a Monday. People who had taken off work to come to his funeral to honor the man. And it was very inspiring. It was some wonderful stories they told. So it was good. It was good. It was good. He lived well. Touched a lot of people's lives. That's cool. Anyways, okay, so I've been thinking and listening, and I've been thinking, I just as a sidebar, this week, just a couple of days ago, I I was thinking, oh, yeah, okay, coming up here in a couple of weeks on May the 4th. Yeah, that's right. I got to take my dad to the doctor's appointment, which the ladies at the doctor's office always love it when I come in, you know, with my costumes with Elf Day and Leprechaun Day and all that kind of stuff. So I was thinking about them. I was thinking, well, maybe I should do something just more than skinny jeans and socks. And then dad also has a hearing aid appointment. I'll probably be filling some prescriptions for him that day. So all these things were kind of spooling around. And then I realized, wait, it's May the 4th. Wait a minute, that's Star Wars Day. And it's on a Friday. And so it was like, oh, okay, well, we got to do something for Star Wars Day. So I started working on that. And, so it's fun. Uh-oh, there's another car parked where Amber's car usually is. I wonder if her little buggy has got a problem. But anyway, so I started thinking about that, started doing that thing, and started ordering some stuff, and, you know, just found a lot of fun stuff. And one thing about these days when I dress up, I intentionally sort of blur the lines a bit when it comes to what would be considered, hey, got the royalty stuff in for... from Random House. Got my $2 in checks. Actually, it's a little more. At this point, it's like a couple hundred dollars or $150 or something like that. But still, it's $150. So there you go. I intentionally kind of blur the lines a little bit in terms of what would be acceptable attire for men to wear. Just because it shakes things up a little bit, you know, the ladies get a big kick out of it. It actually opens up pathways a lot for me to make a connection with some of the women at Walmart that I haven't, some of the workers that I haven't made a connection with yet. All those things help, you know, when they see me all dressed up and, you know, I've got leggings on and short pants and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's just, it sets a certain lessening of expectations of what my behavior might be like. It doesn't matter that I'm a guy, you know, I wear some things that are slightly outrageous for a guy to wear. That makes them grin. That makes them laugh. We have a laugh over it. They relax a little bit. We make a connection. And, you know, I've never had, as a man, I've never had those kind of boundaries in my head of saying, oh, well, I can't wear that. Oh, I can't do that. You know, whoa, people think of me. I just never have had those boundaries in my head. Although, even though the boundaries weren't in my head, the manifestation of that in my outward life has never been as expressive as it is now. And that's fun. But I'm going to be 60 this year. I mean, come on. You know, what does it matter what I wear anymore? I'm going to be 60. So I've been kind of thinking more about that whole thing. And I obviously have thought a lot about gender and all this sexuality and stuff and relationships between men and women. I'm always kind of, I'd like to think about that and figure out what is ideal and where do we go. And I've mentioned in the past that really, you know, one of the big things I think that's happening here is that the flesh takes the very natural reproductive mechanisms and it pushes them to extremes and sows into them bad seed, where if you didn't have the flesh in everyone sowing into those things bad seed, it would look completely different. And I'm already home, but let me see if I can kind of encapsulate what I've been thinking about. It seems to me, oh, and I should say before I start on this, that this does no good for arguments. This does no good for discussions with anyone who doesn't already agree with your viewpoint. Because the more I've listened, the more I've tried to absorb, the more I've reflected on things that someone like a Jordan Peterson is saying, who very correctly puts the left ultra-liberal social justice warrior camps in a philosophical context, very correctly puts them in a philosophical context, the more I realize that it's really just a waste of time. It's a waste of time to attempt to reason in what we would classically consider to be reasonable dialogue. Because what you will find example of over and over and over again is that when someone says, well, let's talk about this, then immediately they're just shouted down and told they're racist or misogynist or, you know, what, exclusivist or whatever. And there's a reason that that happens. And that is that you have to understand that the current far left, the current postmodernists really are birthed out of a postmodernist movement that says there is no absolute truth. The postmodernists, everything's an opinion. There's no absolute truth, and that includes scientific fact. So you can quote all the statistics you want to. It's not going to make any difference. You can create, quote, all the quote-unquote facts that you want to. It's not going to make any difference. And the reason it's not going to make any difference is because there is an absolute denial of absolute truth. So whatever comes out of your mouth, in the opinion of those who are on the far-leaning left in that social warrior camp and that radical feminist camp, whatever comes out of your mouth is simply your opinion, simply your interpretation of truth, and everyone's interpretation of truth is just as valid as everyone else's interpretation of truth. And all that's important is how my truth makes me feel. So when you see this off-quoted statistics like, well, women only make 72 cents on the dollar that men make, and that's terrible, and we need to get to equity, it doesn't do you any good to explain that if you track women's professional lives when they're starting out in their 20s, that that is true. There is a widening wage gap, that it starts fairly small, but it widens quickly, and it widens into their 30s. And then once women come out of their 30s and 40s, they start climbing again. And by the time they get up into their 50s, that, in fact, they've gotten close to reaching parity with men. It doesn't do any good to point that out. It doesn't do any good to point out that a lot of women want to raise a family, and so because of that, they are committing their time to their families. And there's all kinds of ways that you can bring facts into it. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that men are in more dangerous jobs. It doesn't matter that the fatalities every year for work for men far outweigh the fatalities for women, et cetera, et cetera. None of those things matter. All that matters is women only make 72 cents on the dollars poured in men, and that's what makes it obvious there's a patriarchy, and that's true because I feel it's true. I feel it's true, therefore it's true. So don't try to tell me that's not true, because now you're just mansplaining to me. Now you're just showing that you're a misogynist because you don't understand that that's my truth. And for you to tell me that's not true, you know, that's your patriarchal oppression of me. So you got to come at that and understand that set. So if you get yourself into a situation, there's an interesting exchange with Jordan Peterson and Kathy, whatever her name was, on Channel 4 in Britain, where they get into this discussion. And he starts talking about, well, you have to understand the multivariate analysis of this. And she kind of, you know, bristles up because she feels like he's saying that she doesn't understand statistics and she doesn't know what she's talking about. And she's certain that she does. And so as soon as he says that, she does not want to hear anything about his explanation for why she might not know what she's talking about, because she's certain she knows what she's talking about. Because that's her truth. And her truth is just as valid as anyone else's truth. It has nothing to do with the facts. So having said that as a setup, that is the postmodernist mindset. So if you're dealing with someone who buys into that postmodernist mindset, really, just the best thing you can do is be kind and gentle and say, well, I hope that works out for you. Because if you don't do that, all you're just going to get called names and it'll just devolve from there. However, for those of us on this side of it and in kind of looking at this whole gender thing and trying to bring a different perspective for me, I think we've really, and maybe I've said this before, I don't know, I'll just recap it real quick. I think we've really confused things, obviously, but I still am of the mindset that we should reserve the labels men and women specifically to reproductive function. That really, that classic definition of man and woman has been of the man as one who inseminates and the woman as one who incubates. That is the classic role. Now, I realize that there are some people who are sterile. I realize that there are some people who have lost the ability to have children or never had the ability to have children, and they would be offended by being declassified from those two elements. But a lot of that falls into how we want to be perceived, how we want to be desired, how we want to be. It doesn't really fall into the practicality of it. And above that line, then, we have people who were born as inseminators who then say, well, now I want to be called a woman. Well, you're never going to be a woman. You might be effeminate. You might like to wear dresses. You might like to put makeup on. You might like colors. You might like to be softer in your personality. You might like to be one who kind of stays in a more protected place, who doesn't push forward. You might want to be whatever token you want to assign to it. But I think we would do well if we lift all those tokens away from reproductive function and then simply assign to male and female that reproductive function. What that does for somebody like me is that it means that I don't have to be burdened anymore by worrying about whether or not something I wear is going to offend someone because they're confused about what my proclivities might be, what my gender preference might be, what my all those things. I don't care. I just don't care. If it's funny and if it looks cool, I'll do it. I mean, ballet dancers, men wear tights and tight clothing and all that kind of stuff in costuming. There is a whole other set of circumstances than there is in real life. And these are costumes and it's fine. It's fine. And I, I thought this week, this is a little earthy, but I thought this week, you know, that if anyone did get offended with me showing up in my leprechaun outfit with my crushed velvet leggings or my elf outfit with my candy cane striped tights or my upcoming May the 4th outfit with my cartoon black and white cartoon leggings. They are the coolest thing. They are cool. If anyone would get offended by that, a man specifically, that I shouldn't be wearing those leggings. That's why, that's not what a man should wear. You know, I doubt I would say this to them, but my internal response would be, you know, I've given up being concerned about the reactions that men have who truly believe that the entire world exists for the purpose of their insemination. And by that, I mean, when you've got a man who's simply looking around and the triggers are going off on his head whenever he sees legs tightly wrapped in something that may approximate a female form, if he's going to get offended by that, that those legs are actually attached to a guy, what it's really saying is that the only question in his mind continuously is, can I have sex with it? And that is a worldview that extends to how he classifies the rest of the world. And that's a ridiculous worldview. That's really egotistical. It's megalomaniacal. I don't know. It's that word. Anyways, so it's interesting. It's dark. The lights have gone off. It's just very fascinating. And I think what I would love to see that will never happen is that if we could just reserve the terms man and woman down into the reproductive function, male and female down into the reproductive function, and then we could strip off anything else that we've layered on top of that to make it easier for us to peg people in certain functions and certain roles, if we would just strip off all those layers, a lot of really interesting things would happen. You know, we say someone is effeminate as a guy, but so what? Who cares? Who cares? Because it doesn't have anything to do with his capabilities and reproductive functions. Who cares? Who cares? You know, whether men wear long robes or women wear suits or men fix their hair or wear makeup or women don't, or here's a difficult one, or women don't shave their legs and men do. Who cares? Now, I gotta tell you, there's a lot of deeply ingrained stuff in us that when you see, when I see a woman who, you know, doesn't shave her legs, I mean, I've just got to sit myself down and say, okay, that's dumb. Don't, just don't. But, you know, that's because there are things that are deeply ingrained in us. And this is long. Now I'm rambling. Anyways, so, yeah, we'll get back to notes next week. But this whole thing of getting this separated, I don't have this all straight in my head yet, but I think for us who are not on the postmodernist side, it would just be great if we could cogently express what is important in this gender conversation. Understanding that it doesn't matter what we say with a certain group of people, but there's a whole lot of people that are just kind of pinging around in the middle, that if we had a really cogent philosophy that made sense, that didn't condemn, that said, here are the circumstances, let's think about that. If we had a really cogent philosophy, I think we would serve ourselves well, as opposed to, you know, being hard-hearted and sharp of speech and condemning in attitudes when it comes to this whole gender turmoil that we're in a society. And I can't say that I'm all the way there yet where I can just sit down and spit out all the points, but I got a lot of pieces that are swirling around in my head, and I'm going to keep working on it. Anyways, it's been a great week. Had a lot of good conversations with friends, lovely conversations. And just again this week, I was reminded of the power of a single life when I went to Dee Harwood's funeral. The power of a single life, not well known, not flashy, but as he moved through life, he made connections with people, he touched people. And that's a really amazing, amazing thing. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.